Van Against the Grain. Movements like Black Lives Matter have turned a spotlight on the mass criminalization of people of color in the United States. But are we any closer to understanding why the American state locks up its residents in record numbers? I'm Sasha Lilly. Radical scholar Jordan Camp joins me to talk about working class insurgency from below, from the Watts Rebellion to the Los Angeles Uprising, and state repression from above. That's coming right up. From the studios of KPFA in Berkeley, California, this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm Sasha Lilly. One in 35 adults are in prison, on parole, or on probation in the United States. There's no parallel to the American carceral state in any advanced industrial country. Michelle Alexander's best-selling book, The New Jim Crow, laid out the influential argument that Black and Brown Americans, in particular, were being locked up in enormous numbers because of the war on drugs, depriving them of fundamental rights like the right to vote. But scholar Jordan T. Camp takes issue with that argument and suggests that the expansion of American policing, criminalization, incarceration, and repression has a great deal more to do with social upheaval from below and then the formation of a particular form of capitalism, neoliberalism. Camp makes this argument in a new book titled Incarcerating the Crisis: Freedom Struggles and the Rise of the Neoliberal State, published by UC Press. He's a postdoctoral fellow at the Center for the Study of Race and Ethnicity in America at Brown University. Jordan, let's start by talking about Michelle Alexander's argument that mass incarceration was driven by the Nixon and Reagan administration's war on drugs. Why is the war on drugs only part of this story?
Well, thanks, Sasha. And let me also say, you know, thanks so much for having me on the show. I do take issue with the new Jim Crow analogy on two different points. But before I say those, let me just say that without a doubt, Professor Alexander's book has made an important contribution to debates about the pervasive persistence of racism and of criminalization in a purportedly post-civil rights era. And I think, however, that in making her case, she unwittingly reproduces many of the theoretical problems of her contemporaries. And perhaps the most decisive refutation of the new Jim Crow analogy comes about two-thirds of the way through the book, which Alexander states that, you know, stating that mass incarceration is the new Jim Crow can lead to some misapprehensions. Jim Crow and mass incarceration are historically distinct formations. Now, I'm paraphrasing there, but that's the, you know, the basic argument. And I couldn't agree more. We need to be historically specific. That's one way, and I can say more about that. To your point, or question rather, about the drug war, you know, Alexander argues that the war on drugs that, you know, targets particularly African-American men from kind of Nixon and Reagan on has been the primary engine or driver of mass incarceration. She says that it's primarily been conservatives who have appealed to kind of economic anxieties of whites in the context of deindustrialization. And there's, you know, no doubt that conservative politicians have demonized, racialized, criminalized the Black and Latino poor through a war on drugs. The problem that I have with this thesis is that, one, it makes it so that it alleviates the responsibilities of liberals in this project of mass criminalization that's been unprecedented, as you said, in U.S. and world history. So I want to intervene that there's been a bipartisan consensus about criminalization. The second part is that if you look at the evidentiary basis around the drug war and who's in prison, I concur with the work of political scientist Marie Godshaw, who has intervened in her new book, that even if you released everyone arrested on drug charges tomorrow, we'd still have the largest carceral apparatus on the planet. So incarcerating the crisis asks, you know, why this is, where it came from. And again, I think it's from a bipartisan consensus about prioritizing security with roots in the early Cold War and the neoliberal turn in U.S. and global capitalism.
And we'll talk all about what you mean by those different terms. One of the things that you do in the book, Incarcerating the Crisis Jordan Camp, is that you argue for the importance of history and looking at mass incarceration through a much broader lens. And you take issue with those who might see mass incarceration as going back, as you just mentioned, to Nixon and Reagan. And you actually say we should start thinking about the forces that led up to mass incarceration starting in the 1930s. I want to ask you about the 1930s specifically, but let me just ask you to draw out kind of the heart of your argument, because what you are arguing is that there is an interplay, a dialectic, if you will, in the United States historically between forces from below and then forces from above, what you call insurgency and counterinsurgency. Can you just spell that out for us? And then I'd like to ask you specifically about understanding the beginning of the trajectory that got us to where we are.
Yeah, well, what I'm arguing is that, you know, most accounts of carceral state formation begin with a project of the right in the 1960s to explain the roots of this unprecedented prison project that, you know, takes off from 1975 to the present. And the argument goes something like this, that, you know, it takes hold as liberalism wanes in the 1960s and the dominance of the right, you know, takes hold in this same period. And I argue forcefully against this thesis because I think it willfully ignores evidence that shows that Cold War racial liberalism engaged in a project of law and order that, in my estimation, was a counterinsurgent response to the most radical political and economic demands of an alliance between Black freedom, radical labor, and socialist movements with roots in the 1930s. In other words, that this project of expanding policing and prisons to win consent to violent coercion emerges directly in response to this insurgent thrust of the roots in the 30s, and then finds a political hold in the 1960s and 1970s and jumps scales. And so indeed, the dialectics, as you suggest, of insurgency and of counterinsurgency are the centerpiece of my theoretical analysis of state formation in the U.S.
Okay, and just to clarify, when you're talking about neoliberal state formation, you're talking about the emergence, which usually is dated to the early 1970s, of a new form of capitalism, of ordering capitalism, in which the welfare state is chopped away, the free market is supposed to work its magic unfettered, there is a transformation of regulation, and it's often characterized as a kind of a class war from above. So what you're talking about then is what led up to this moment when neoliberalism was established, and what's the relationship between neoliberalism and the carceral state or this mass prison population? Is that right?
Yeah, I mean, I think this is exactly right. And, you know, I may add just a couple of things. You know, the neoliberal project is, you know, often the origins of the project is often located in the CIA-backed coup in Chile in the early 1970s, and then the kind of argument goes that it, you know, circulates around the planet. And what I want to do is to reconsider this, look at some events earlier than the Chilean coup, and you know, better understand the relationship between the crushing of mass anti-racist and class struggles in the United States in the post-war period and the slashing of social budgets, education, health care, otherwise known as a social wage, and the imposition of this new form of class rule. It's not that I don't think the 1970s was a turning point. It's just that I want to argue that the increasing geographical scale of the civil rights insurgency and mass protests against Jim Crow racial regimes was a factor in the increasing centrality of mass arrest, confinement, and incarceration in the governance of US neoliberal capitalism. And far from a kind of inevitable formation that emerged out of all of a sudden, in the 1970s, I argue that this racialized formation of the enemies of the US state has been essential to the neoliberal turn, and that, these fears and anxieties that were constructed in the early Cold War against communism, right, shifts to where there's a new domestic enemy, and it's, the criminal, right? Particularly in the 1960s, and that these narratives of security, law, and order were critical to building a kind of nationalist consent to the construction of the neoliberal apparatus. I'm not the only one, of course, that traces these earlier roots. I mean, David Harvey in A Brief History of Neoliberalism certainly looks at the 1940s as being a critical turning point and looked at this earlier buildup. I just want to lay some critical pressure on the ways in which, again, the crushing of Black freedom, radical labor, and socialist movements in the United States was a factor in neoliberal state formation that I think to this point has been rather neglected.
And we'll talk more about that as we go. I should say that I'm speaking to Jordan T. Camp. He is the author of Incarcerating the Crisis, and he's a postdoctoral fellow at Brown University. So let us then go back to the politics from below that you are arguing were countered preceding the rise of neoliberalism, and then in many ways those processes unfolded in different ways following the emergence of neoliberalism. So let's just go back. Tell us about the kind of politics that came into alliance in the 1930s, in the 1940s, in the 1950s, which Cold War liberalism was keen on repressing, this melding or interaction between radical labor, Black freedom struggles, and socialist politics.
In making this argument about a kind of long civil rights movement, I'm joining literature among predominantly historians that are pushing, the periodization of the civil rights movement far earlier than the Brown decision in the 1950s, and locating it in this dramatic upsurge of labor where African-American workers and unions played a key role in the formation of the Congress of Industrial Organizations and the development of a kind of working class power that was, in my mind, unprecedented on a world scale, surpassed anything except for maybe Russia in 1917. And that the Black freedom movement or the long civil rights movement has its roots in campaigns around, the freedom for the Scottsboro Boys or the African-American young men criminalized in Alabama in the 1930s, the unemployment councils, the anti-imperialist, anti-racist ferment of the 1930s. And this program that developed out of the, trade union and labor and civil rights alliance pressed for, access to the social wage programs of the New Deal that Black workers and Mexican-American workers, agricultural and the domestic sectors of the working class had been excluded from. And this vision was most clearly articulated perhaps by figures like W.E.B. Du Bois, Paul Robeson, Claudia Jones, C.L.R. James, and so on. And what I think these Black freedom movement intellectuals argued is that, in order to create a kind of democratic transition to socialism that first you had to, you know, have basic, you know, voting rights, and that people had to have some train of political equality to have this transition to economic equality. And of course, you know, this was in the context of Jim Crow, where workers of different races were segregated into different places, and argue that this alliance and that came together in the socialist project against Jim Crow from the 30s to the 1960s created a crisis of legitimacy for Jim Crow capitalism. What do I mean by that? I mean that, you know, this was a capitalism that used segregation to drive down wages for sectors of the working class in order to legitimate a downward pressure on wages for the proletariat as a whole. Now, in the 60s, of course, you know, with the passage of the civil rights legislation, this Jim Crow racial regime enters into a crisis, and it's a problem for the state. And the basic argument is that in this period, we see the development of new forms of racist social control in order to manage a transition in the political economy that also takes shape in this exact historical conjuncture. And that is, you know, kind of crisis of Fordism, of mass unionism, of the kind of Fordist production lines that had characterized industrial capitalism. And with it became increasing unemployment as a result of capital flight and deindustrialization. And this created a crisis for the state. And the state develops a new form of racist social control to manage the kind of production of a surplus labor force that's created out of this fundamental turning point in the history of U.S. capitalism.
Well, let's talk about some of the turning points then that kind of line up with this key moment. So in the 1960s, you have the march of the civil rights movement and the kind of alliances you've been talking about. You have a kind of peaking of profitability for American capitalism and then decline in the late 1960s. And then, of course, you have these social rebellions that take place, often termed riots. You may want to weigh in on why you choose to use the language that you do. But one of these is the Watts riots, or the Watts insurrection, that took place in 1965. Can you remind listeners what took place there, what set it off, and how significant it was in understanding the dialectic of insurgency and counterinsurgency that's so fundamental to the argument that you're making?
In 1965, just days after the passage of the civil rights legislation, there was the largest urban uprising in U.S. urban history that took place in Watts in Los Angeles, California. And the spark for that rebellion was the California Highway Patrol pulled over an unarmed black resident who was driving his car and proceeded to beat him. His name was Marquette Frye. He was also unemployed. And this event was experienced as a kind of symptomatic event for the residents of South Central Los Angeles. It occurred in the context of a string of police violence and killings of black working class residents in California. And, you know, of course, the insurrection led to wide-scale burning and looting to protest the criminalization of the black working class. And what I'm arguing is that this dramatic event marked, as you suggest, a critical turning point in a kind of onset of a new conjuncture, and that is a relationship between political, economic, and ideological forces. It was in the context of this mass insurgency that we see increased attention by the Black Freedom Movement to this problem of persistent unemployment. I mean, Martin Luther King goes to Watts after the uprising to meet with the participants in the event, and he surmises that this was a class revolt of the underprivileged against the privileged. And he says it showed us that the material conditions had remained the same despite the passage of the civil rights legislation. And it's in this context that the Black Freedom Movement kind of shifts gears and starts paying attention to questions of class inequality that had been silenced during the early Cold War because you know, it had been a decade or more where any question of class in the Black Freedom Movement was off the table from Cold War racial liberals. And what King says in this context is that, you know, and this is almost a quote, I'm paraphrasing, he says, you know, we have to start paying attention to capitalism, that we need a better distribution of wealth, and maybe we should, you know, look towards a kind of democratic socialism. After all, in Watts, there was a 34% unemployment for African-American workers. These were conditions that were akin to the unemployment rates experienced by the American working class as a whole in the 1930s. So this moment marked, I think, the decline of Fordism, Fordist industrial capitalism, the emergence of permanent structural unemployment. And of course, then, the repression of the rebellion, right, and the crushing of that insurrection led to the rise of Ronald Reagan to the governor's mansion in California. And he implements policies to expand the authoritarian mechanisms of the state security apparatus and policing. You know, he targets the Black Panther Party that's formed in 1966 in Oakland to, you know, defend Black working class residents against police violence again in the wake of the Watts insurrection. And, you know, the repression that he unleashes in California, I think, provides a kind of political foundation for the development and the expansion of neoliberal policies at the national and global scale after President Ronald Reagan, you know, achieves power in the early 1980s.
Let me ask you this question, which you've sort of touched on, just to make it explicit. You've been discussing mass incarceration and repression in the United States. And you also have talked about the rise of neoliberalism in the 1970s, established often the sort of shorthand as free market fundamentalism. Can you just make explicit what the relationship is between mass incarceration and neoliberalism?
Yeah, you know, the basic argument that I want to make about the relationship between this mass criminalization and the neoliberal turn is that the making of the neoliberal state has been accompanied by the production of a racist and revanchist common sense. And in this way, I'm following the lead of the geographer Neil Smith in using this term revanchism, which literally means revenge. And of course, it was first used to describe how the bourgeoisie exploited populism and nationalism to legitimate the crushing of the Paris Commune in 1871 and help mobilize the spirit of revenge against insurgents who were represented as enemies of the nation. And what I'm arguing is that this revanchist spirit has been revived in this long counterinsurgency against the Black freedom struggle and the tilt towards a more authoritarian state that takes shape in this specific historical conjuncture of the 1970s. And what the essential intervention here is that neoliberal state formation cannot be, or is rather inconceivable, outside of the context of mass anti-racist and class struggle that takes place in cities and prisons. So, you know, the chapter on the Attica uprising, I think, is instructive in this regard. You know, in 1971, this multiracial group of prisoners, African-American, Puerto Rican, and some poor whites take over a sector of that prison to, you know, demonstrate against the deplorable and dehumanizing conditions that they faced in that prison. And that revolt was the culmination of a cycle of rebellion through the American prison system that had rocked the United States from 1968 to 1971. And what I argue is that in the wake of the crushing of this rebellion, when Nelson Rockefeller deploys troops in a bloody massacre that, you know, killed not only the insurgent prisoners, but the hostages that they took in the rebellion, that neoliberals exploited a series of moral panics about race and crime to justify the gutting of the social wage and the expansion of policing and prisons. And there's this kind of revanchist ideologies, organized fears that were created by the economic crisis. Of course, we know that it was in the early 1970s. Most people say 73, but I date it back with David McNally and others to 1971, that we have the sharpest economic downturn since the Great Depression. Right? We have the crashing of global markets. And in this context, neoliberals in New York say, you know, kind of famously, we're not going to bail out, you know, the city. And it leads to what Harvey describes as a coup as great as the one in Chile, but it's primarily financial. And what I want us to think about is that it's inconceivable that you could win consent to the slashing of social budgets without this specter of the militant Black and Latino poor having unfettered access to the welfare state and, you know, this draining on social budgets. And, you know, the way that we can fix this problem is just to eliminate that and control this problem of disorder and chaos and kind of rioting through the expansion of policing and prisons. And it's in this exact moment that we can trace the unprecedented buildup of the prison population. You know, it's about 200,000 in the late 1960s. It doubles to over 400,000 by the 1980s. And then, of course, you know, the story that's pretty well known is that by the early 2000s, we have over, 2 million prisoners at the same time that we have a fundamental neoliberal restructuring of the political economy. And what I want to do is to think together these political, economic, ideological processes that are traditionally thought apart.
Right, and I think that's a crucial part of the argument, and we'll talk a bit more about moral panics and what they allow. But just to be absolutely clear, so are you saying that the relationship between mass criminalization and neoliberalism is simply that the criminalization, the demonization of the Black freedom struggle, of poor Blacks in particular, creating social disorder, allowed the rest of the working class, particularly the white working class, to go along with the rollback of what would be called the social welfare state, the removal of the social welfare state, because they had been pulled along on this sort of racialized ideological project? Or would you say that there is also something about neoliberalism that benefits in some way from mass incarceration? And if it's the case, how does that square with the fact that you have other neoliberal states in other countries around the world, which, while repressive, don't have anywhere near the number of prisoners that the U.S. does?
Yeah, I don't think this is simply a question of the ways in which white workers consented to the criminalization of the Black and Latino poor. I mean, I actually am trying to argue something a bit more complex than that. And the reason being is because, you know, I mean, for one, the majority of the people who are incarcerated by the carceral apparatus were white.
Sure.
Until the 1980s. I mean, this is a dramatic shift in the period I'm studying in the race and class composition of those who are incarcerated. But, you know, it's one of the reasons I focus on ideology so much in the book, Sasha, because in each of these events, it's as if it's imagined that, you know, the uprising, for example, that I look in Detroit was predominantly Black, right? When the evidence suggests that it was Black and white workers in the streets. But the racial ideology that depicts the event as primarily Black, right, I'm arguing, helps win consent, I think, not from workers, but from the petty bourgeoisie, and right, to support policies, and certainly sectors of the working class, right, to support policies that were against, you know, workers' interests. And that's a key part of the argument, right? Attica, when you say Attica, people still imagine it's singularly Black, right? We don't see Black, Latino, and white. Or even in Los Angeles in 1992, the, you know, major uprising that rocked Southern California. Again, you know, we have this kind of imagination that this is a riot in South Central amongst the kind of, you know, Black underclass. And of course, you know, this is a mystification that obscures more than it explains. I mean, that was, you know, as Mike Davis pointed out so many years ago, you know, a multi-ethnic rising of the poor. And what I'm trying to argue, I guess, is that it's this criminalization of, you know, the multiracial efforts of the poor that has been critical, or the criminalization of dissent is critical as a political foundation for the neoliberal carceral state. Now, to the point about how incarceration and neoliberal state formation works together, I mean, I don't think that prisons and policing in any way contradict the you know, neoliberal state's efforts towards imposing a kind of marketization of everything, a fiscalization. It only ruptures its ideological formation. And that is because, of course, you know, neoliberals often claim, right, that they want a smaller state, that they're, you know, against big government and so on. Of course, you know, and this has been pointed out by scholars before me. I mean, you know, Ruth Wilson Gilmore's Golden Gulag, I think, is foundational in showing that this is how neoliberals were able to basically secure votes, right, so that they could get into office in places like California. And then, you know, the first thing that they do is they don't, you know, they want to slash the social side, but they want to expand, you know, the expenditure for policing, prisons, and security. And, you know, to your point about how this compares with other neoliberal states, I mean, I think that in some ways we have to remain, you know, in this era of global capitalism, we have to look at how a conjuncture takes shape in specific countries. So whereas you may not have, you know, the levels of incarceration that you do in the U.S., certainly in places like the U.K., you've seen, you know, increasing numbers of people and disproportionately Black people incarcerated. South Africa, a neoliberal state, continues to pursue policing in prisons. In all of these neoliberal states, if we understand incarceration on a continuum of a repressive state apparatus that includes policing, prisons, and permanent war, there's no contradiction between thinking about this expanding coercive apparatus and the ways in which neoliberal state formation has taken shape in this dramatic period that we live in.
You're listening to Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My name is Sasha Lilly, and today we're discussing the mass criminalization of African American and other working classes in the United States and the relationship between mass criminalization and incarceration and capitalism, particularly neoliberal capitalism. I'm joined by Jordan T. Camp, who wrote Incarcerating the Crisis, Freedom Struggles and the Rise of the Neoliberal State. That's published by UC Press, and you can find a link to it on our website, againstthegrain.org. He's also co-editor of Policing the Planet, While the Policing Crisis Led to Black Lives Matter. I wanted to ask you, Jordan, backing up just slightly, to talk about one of the rebellions that you briefly touched on, but you explore extensively in your book, Incarcerating the Crisis. And that is the rebellion that took place in Detroit in 1967, because it's illustrative of the kinds of insurgent politics that you argue have been very consciously tamped down with the expansion of mass incarceration, mass criminalization. So tell us about the social and political context to the Detroit Rebellion of 1967.
Yeah, well, thank you. And I was really hoping you were going to ask me about this dramatic event, Sasha, because, you know, in Detroit in 1967 and 1968, we have, you know, some of the most dramatic labor and freedom upsurges that I think the U.S. has ever seen. You know, when we think about 1968, we often have an understanding about the, you know, student and worker revolts in Paris or in Mexico City in 1968 and this kind of global upsurge. But I think that the class struggles in Detroit in this period have, again, been kind of downplayed or overlooked. In 1967, of course, we have the onset of what becomes the largest urban insurrection following Watts in 1965. And the event begins as a Vietnam soldier, African-American soldier, is returning. And they have a party for him in one of the poorest working class districts in the city of Detroit. And the party takes place as what's called a blind pig or an after hours club. And these blind pigs, you know, served alcohol after the, I think it was 2 a.m. where, you know, you're officially supposed to stop serving drinks. But it was a common practice in the city of Detroit because that's when the late shift ends at the auto plants, right? And, you know, at this party, there are 80 or a little more people there, and the cops show up. And usually, you know, the cops make people disperse, maybe arrest a few. But on that night, they arrested everyone, and it really angers the residents who considered it an attack on this cherished custom for the working people of Detroit. And it sparked, burning and looting as a response to this mass criminalization. In the days that followed, you know, National Guardsmen were deployed into the streets of Detroit to purportedly, restore law and order. But the other side of the dialectic is that this attempt to crush this, and as I said before, it was a multiracial rising of the working class also sparked an increasing militancy by auto workers in that city. I mean, one of the people that I interviewed for the book, General Gordon Baker, was a participant in that event. And he says that when he was arrested and he was taken to a local prison, that everyone who was incarcerated, he said, you know, look, just like the assembly lines. And one of the things that he suggests is that the event quickened the step of the working class because they realized their ability to alter the relations of class power at the point of production, because what they had been able to do was to shut down, at least for a short period, the night shift, because they refused to work in large numbers. And when we think about this claim, I think we should compare it to Marx and Engels' insights about the Paris Commune, where they celebrated the, you know, for a brief period, the abolition of night work for bakers. And I think that also, you know, General Baker was the a key member in the formation of the League of Revolutionary Black Workers, who came together, you know, out of this insurrection, which they referred to as the Great Rebellion of 1967. And what they tried to do was organize black workers at the point of production to implement a democratic transition to socialism. They used newspapers like the Inner City Voice. They also created a film, which I talk about in some detail, called Finally Got the News, in order to circulate their insurgent vision about black workers leading the overthrow of capitalism. And this seemed like a distinct possibility in this moment. After all, it occurred amidst the largest wave of wildcat strikes in U.S. history since 1946, and I think animated the visions, again, of the working class as a whole. They also argued forcefully against this kind of emergent law and order rhetoric, which they saw as a cover for capital's abandonment of the people and the place that had built up its power. I mean, you know, the final thing is, that I'll say about this is that the League of Revolutionary Black Workers, insurgent, anti-racist, socialist critique of this law and order rhetoric as a justification for kind of austerity and cuts in social budgets and expanding policing, of course, proved to be prophetic about the ways in which the state and capital's response to these events in cities and prisons provided the kind of roots of the contemporary conjuncture.
Well, moving us then, Jordan Kemp, to the contemporary conjuncture, of course, people's minds naturally go to Black Lives Matter. I'd like to, though, ask you about something that took place in our period, which is the events that followed post-Katrina New Orleans in 2005. Why do you include that in your examination of rebellion from below, repression from above?
One thing is to say that the state's response to that event was not a response to, you know, a natural disaster, as so many narratives asserted. It was far from natural. It was rather a product of the neoliberalization of the political economy that had totally transformed the urban and rural landscapes of the United States over four decades. After all, you know, the state's response to that crisis need to be situated, as I do in the book, in the context of Louisiana having the highest concentration of prisoners anywhere in the country. It's the state's, Louisiana is the most carceral state in the United States, which is the largest carceral state on the planet, and there are more people incarcerated from Louisiana than anywhere else. So you need to be able to understand when we saw the abandonment of the black working class in those floodwaters to drown, and when they were criminalized for being looters and so on, that rhetoric and those set of policies and that action had precedent. I mean, the most immediate precedent, I think, was the events in LA in 1992, and I think that where similarly, the participants in that event were described as looters and insurrectionists and so on. Also, that the state's deployment of the military, in the name of fighting insurgency, right, draws on this repertoire from the events in Detroit in 1967, LA in 1992. You know, they didn't see themselves as going in to, implement a rescue mission. They described, and I quote at length, military officials saying that they were fighting an insurgency, right? So this long counterinsurgency that had underpinned the neoliberal state provided the kind of ideological rationale, state capacity, and justification for this management of social and economic crisis. The other thing is that the resistance in that city to the gutting of the social wage, I mean, after all, right after Hurricane Katrina, city officials en masse fire all the unionized teachers in New Orleans public schools, busting one of the largest unions in Louisiana. They're disproportionately a majority African-American workers, eliminate public housing, destroying undamaged buildings that residents by the hundreds of thousands who had been displaced could have returned. And, I think that people like Malcolm Suber, like Sonny Patterson, like Kalamu Yassalam also, draw on this deep reservoir of the long civil rights movement and making an argument that this outcome was far from inevitable. It was not natural, that rather we could have had redistributive justice. We could have had an expanded public sector after this event, and that there's unfinished business from the long freedom struggle that I trace in the book that is dramatically shown by post-Katrina New Orleans. And they've offered a vision of social and economic justice that I think reanimated the global justice movement that was in a crisis in this post 9/11 period to the expansion of security and policing and so on. And so I think that that event is one of the critical turning points in U.S. history for understanding both the problems that we've got to face, but also the alternative futures that are not only possible, but absolutely necessary.
Well, we are running out of time, but I don't want to end without asking you about the present moment. There is really unprecedented awareness of the racialized violence that the police in this country mete out. You have social movements springing up, most obviously Black Lives Matter. How do you understand this moment, and are there any lessons that you would bring to bear?
Yeah, I think that we're living in a crisis of policing and prisons, in the wake of the events in Ferguson, the wake of the events in Baltimore, the formation of the Black Lives Matter movement and the movement for Black Lives, where we're seeing a rupture of the common sense that has underpinned this political and economic transformation that I trace in the book. And I think that there's potential here to develop a vision of anti-racist, of redistributive justice, and to directly confront the neoliberal state. It shows that there is, again, an unfinished business of the project of abolition, democracy. And I think the lesson is we need to learn to listen to these young people who have taken the lead, young Black people in particular. I mean, look at BYP, Black Youth Project 100, whose epicenter is in Chicago, but they've got chapters all around the country. And they've just laid out a platform, you know, and a program for this movement for Black lives that puts economic justice, a struggle against racist state violence, right at the center. And in doing so, I think that they're calling into question this Cold War consensus that had put questions of race and class off the table. And this is very hopeful because, of course, you know, the outcome of this crisis will not be determined in advance. It will be the product of a political and ideological struggle. As such, it creates an opportunity for the left as a whole. And we need to get serious, those of us on the left, about how we can support these movements because, you know, the stakes are high.
Well, Jordan Camp, thank you so much for joining me today. It's been a pleasure having you on.
Sasha, anytime. I'm a big fan of the show, and thank you so much for the serious work that you do.
I've been speaking with the author of Incarcerating the Crisis, Freedom Struggles and the Rise of the Neoliberal State. That's published by UC Press. You can find a link to it at againstthegrain.org. Jordan Camp is postdoctoral fellow in the Center for the Study of Race and Ethnicity in America at Brown University. You've been listening to Against the Grain. I'm Sasha Lilly. Thanks so much for listening, and please tune in again next time. Against the Grain is produced by Sasha Lilly and C.S. Song. Please visit us online at againstthegrain.org, where you'll find on-demand and downloadable audio and a way to sign up for our podcast. And you can check us out on Facebook at Against the Grain Radio or follow us on Twitter at Radio Against.